The Manitoba Association of Christian Homeschools would like to thank the Learning House for sponsoring this recording.
This session is entitled Helping the Hyperactive Child. I'm Israel Wayne. And I want to begin this presentation by defining some terms. You may have heard of the acronyms ADD and ADHD. ADD is attention deficit disorder, and ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And I'm going to give you a definition from the American Psychiatric Association on ADHD. And so here's how they define that. Quote, fidgets, squirms, or seems restless. Has difficulty remaining seated. Is easily distracted. Has difficulty awaiting turn. Blurts out answers. Has difficulty following instructions. Has difficulty sustaining attention. Shifts from one uncompleted task to another. Has difficulty playing quietly. Talks excessively. Interrupts or intrudes on others. Does not seem to listen. Often loses things necessary for tasks. Frequently engages in dangerous actions. Okay, so I can come to kind of know the audience here a little bit and to see how relevant this is. Please raise your hand if this sounds like it describes your husband. Okay, I thought so. And then ADD is described this way. The primary and most significant characteristic is inattentiveness. Hyperactivity is not present. Nevertheless, these children still manifest problems with organization and distractibility, and they may be seen as quiet or passive in nature. So I'm going to run a disclaimer and say at the beginning, I'm not a medical doctor. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a pediatrician. So my perspective and my interest in this is really something that initially came out of my own experience. I was homeschooled, and I was hyperactive. And so as a child, this was something that, in fact, let me just tell you the first time that I ever heard the term ADHD. I was about 6 years old, and we had been, we'd been caught homeschooling again. And I think I told you, some of you maybe don't go to all of my sessions. So it was against the law in those days. And so we had to come in and be standardized tested, which was kind of crazy, right? Because I didn't know how to read. So what I did is I just kind of, you know how they have those bubbles with multiple choice? I just sort of filled in the bubbles in different random places. I doubt that was very effective. I don't know what my score was. But I do know that it was a public school teacher who was administering the test to me. And I could tell she didn't like me. Which actually wasn't surprising to me because most adults didn't like me. I was kind of used to that. But I remember after I took the test, you know, she just kind of scowled at me the whole time and just was very unimpressed with me. But she made me go stand out in the hallway because she wanted to talk to my mother. And so she's talking to my mother and they left the door open and I'm standing in the hallway. So I heard all of it. I don't know what the point of that was. But she said to my mother, she said, I have been a public school teacher for 25 years and my whole career has been spent working with children. And she said, your son has ADHD. I know it when I see it. I work with lots of children who have ADHD. Your son has ADHD. And I could tell my mom wasn't too happy with the conversation, but she didn't really argue back too much. And so when we got in the car and we were driving home from the whole experience, I decided to have a very direct conversation with my mother because one of the things I'd learned as a child is that when adults don't want a child to know what they're talking about, they spell it. You know what I'm saying? Like when parents say, you know, after the KIDS, go to BED, we can have some ICECREAM, right? You know, that kind of thing. And so I knew this was one of those moments where she doesn't want my mom, she doesn't want me to know what she's telling my mom, so she's spelling it. I didn't know how to spell, right? You know. So I told my mom, I said, listen, I heard you and the teacher talking, and I just want you to shoot straight with me. Like, I can handle it. I just need to know for myself. I just need to know the truth. So don't sugarcoat it. Just give it to me straight. How long do I have to live? And my mom said, what? And I said, look, it's okay. I'm all right. Like, I'm fine with it. I just need to know how long I have. And my mom says, what are you talking about? I said, I heard you talking with the teacher, and I heard her tell you that I have cancer. And, you know, I'm fine with that. I don't mind dying. I just kind of want to know what my lifespan is at this point. And she's like, what are you talking about? You don't have cancer? I said, I don't? And she says, no. And I said, but isn't that what ADHD spells? And my mom said, no, that doesn't spell cancer. I said, oh, what does it spell? She said, it spells bad. I said, oh, you mean I'm not going to die? She goes, well, not unless you act like that again. Anyway, I grew up, I came out of the womb hyperactive. I started walking and talking at 8 months, and my mom said I just never shut up after that. It was so crazy. One of the things that I remember is one of my earliest memories was I developed a fixation with ingesting toxic chemicals into my body. Now, in the United States, they had these little green, we'd call them today, little green emojis that were stickers that they gave to parents. The Poison Control Center gave it, and you were to put it on all of the cleaning products in your house, and they called it a Mr. Yuck sticker. And so you put the Mr. Yuck sticker, and it had the opposite effect for me as a toddler, because it would always kind of identify for me a new chemical I hadn't ingested yet. And so I drank lighter fluid, I drank bleach. My mom said one of the worst ones, I was like 18 months, I drank kerosene, and she said that was tough for me because I was still in a crib, and the kerosene made me belch, and I didn't like the fumes, but I couldn't get far enough away from the fumes, so I was kind of annoying myself with it. And she used to call Poison Control Center, and it was, they didn't have auto dial or speed dial back then, but they knew my mom on a first name basis, and they would be like, okay, so what did Israel do now? And I was sort of like a pet project for them, because they were like, okay, so we're going to try this. Take some vinegar and some mustard and some ipecac and some milk of magnesium and mix that all up and give it to him. And somehow I had this like ironclad constitution where all of that plus the poisonous chemicals just stayed down there and swam around. And then my face would turn green like the green Mr. Yuck emoji. And so that was my initial interest. And then one day when I was about 2 to 2.5, we lived in a single wide trailer. And my mom was in the kitchen making lunch, and I was in the living room, which is literally like, what, 8 feet away, you know? It's like this small little single-wide trailer. But my mom turned her back for a moment, and she heard this pop. And she turned around in time to see me flying across the room. I had stuck a bobby pin into the electric socket. And so she ran across the room to the living room, and I was laying on the floor completely non-responsive. And of course, as a mother, she did what every good mother would do. She panicked. And so she starts screaming at me, and I'm not answering. I'm just laying there with my eyes closed, and she thinks I've probably died or I'm about to. So she said, finally, after a minute, I slowly started to open my eyes, and then my eyes kind of like snapped back together and refocused. And she was like, Israel, are you okay? Are you okay? And she said, the first thing came out of my mouth was, wow. And so that then started a whole new interest for me of kind of getting regularly electrocuted. And the thing about me was I rarely ever did the same exact dumb thing twice. There were just so many new things to try for the first time. And my mom tried her best. She really tried to watch me. I remember I was in a blizzard in northern Indiana. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of the blizzard of 78. But 1977 and 78, the Midwest of the United States had the coldest blizzard on record. And I decided, as a little kid, take my diaper off and take all my clothes off and go run out in the blizzard of 78 nude through the neighborhood. And fortunately for me, a neighbor found me, and unfortunately for my mother, brought me back. And so I just, was inquisitive. I always had to find out what would happen if. We moved out east, and we moved into this house that was an older house, and it had a basement that I wasn't allowed to go in. And of course, as a kid, if you know you're not allowed to do something, you know there's a really high level of, like, there's a reason I'm not allowed down there, and I need to know what it is. And so I waited for my opportunity, and I found it on a Saturday afternoon. My mom was upstairs vacuuming the floor, and she had the stereo on, and she was playing it really loud. And so did I tell you that I had a perfect older sister? I didn't. Okay. Well, my perfect older sister was named Sony, like the electronics company, you know, the stereos, the TVs, right? Sony. That's my older sister. My name is Israel. Hers is Sony. The only thing I can say is people smoked some things they shouldn't have in the 70s. Yeah, I'm glad I got the better name. But my sister was one of these perfect, complacent, compliant childs. My mom joked that she had started a book on how to raise a perfect child in one easy lesson. And then I was born and she burned the manuscript. But my older sister was to me what Jiminy Cricket was to Pinocchio. She was my moral conscience, and she would follow me around and hover and say, Israel, I don't think you should do that. I don't think that's a good idea. And I told her one day, I said, this is my chance. I'm going to go down in the basement. She said, but we're not allowed to go down in the basement. Do you ever have a sibling like that? Never got in trouble, never did anything wrong. Disgusting. And so I was like, look, I'm going down there with or without you. She's like, oh, well, I guess I better go down there and make sure you don't get into trouble. And so I go down there, and it was, first of all, it was a scary basement. You know, spider webs and stuff everywhere. It was pretty scary. But it was also kind of boring. Like, there wasn't that much down there. There wasn't much of interest. But then I saw this little gray box up on the wall. And I thought, I wonder what that is. So I got a 5-gallon bucket, and I scooted it over there. I climbed up there, opened up the panel. And I looked in, there's a bunch of switches. And I thought, I wonder what these do. So I just started randomly flipping all the switches. Flip, 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 flip. And I thought, man, this is boring. These don't do anything. And then I saw this really big switch up at the top. It said M-A-I-N. I thought, I wonder what that thing does. So I grabbed it and I started flipping it. Flip, 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 flip. And I'm down in the basement, and from the second floor of our house, I hear my mother. She was still a screamer back then. She eventually lost her voice, which was great. And she was like, Israel! That ruined my life. And I'll tell you why. Because it was in that moment that I understood I don't have a chance in life, because there is no way my mother could possibly know what I was doing and where I was. She knew right where to come and get me. And I'm thinking to myself, this is so unfair, because God tells my mother everything that I do. I will never get away with anything. It was only years later that I kind of understood the dynamic, that she's vacuuming the floor, the lights are going off, the lights are coming on, the stereo's going off, the vacuum is like, you know, I mean, she knew exactly where to go and look for me. But I also had this propensity to, like, say the wrong things at the wrong time, right? Like, I've learned that most people have a filter between their brain and their mouth. And I don't know exactly how it works, but I think it's like there's a committee that kind of makes decisions about, so like a thought starts to form in the brain, they send it to the committee, and the committee's like, well, you know, that's kind of okay. However, we'd make these modifications, might be a little more socially acceptable. And then they send it back to the brain. The brain's like, yeah, that would be better. And then eventually it gets to the mouth and it comes out. It's something like that. I've never had that. My process is like, think it, say it. And I've always just kind of been forthright. And even as a little kid, you know, I was just kind of out there. Like, I remember we had these neighbors that moved in next door, and I was 3, my sister was 5, And they had a girl and a boy that were exactly our ages. So their parents thought it would be a good idea for their family to get to be friends with our family. Now, thank God people don't do this anymore in our day and age. But back in this time, people still thought it was a good idea to know their neighbors, right? So our parents invited them over to our house to have dinner with us. And so we sit around the table and we're about to eat. And one of the traditions in our home was that we would pray before we ate. And so we engage in this practice of praying before that we eat the food. And it was in that moment that I realized that our neighbors were heathens and that they weren't saved and they didn't know Jesus. And the way that I knew this was because they didn't close their eyes when they prayed. Don't ask me how I knew that they didn't close their eyes when they prayed. But there was this awkward pause after the prayer, where nobody quite knows what to say or what to do. I don't do awkward pauses well. I read an article about this, that the average person has a 6-second silence pain threshold. That if in the course of a conversation, no one says anything for 6 seconds, it becomes awkward and uncomfortable, and they feel a compulsion that they should speak up and say something to sort of keep the conversation going. 6 seconds is a fairly long time. Something like, that long. And then you feel like, I need to say something. Well, my silence pain threshold is something like 0.006 seconds. Okay, so I just hate awkward pauses. And I thought to myself, and I was evangelistic even back then at 3 years old, and I just thought to myself, you know, we what are we doing here? We're wasting time. I just said to the dad, because I figured that was the most appropriate thing to say, you know, to him as the head of the household. I said, sir, I just have to tell you, you're going to hell. And so is your wife, and so are your kids. And my mom, like, stuffed a biscuit in my mouth and remembered something supposedly burning out in the kitchen. And then we moved. And the other thing was, I found that there were places that you could have fun that other people didn't know you were supposed to have fun, right? So, like, I remember one time being on a discussion panel about this ADD thing, and the discussion panelist said, you know, tell us about how you suffered with ADHD. I was like, no, I never suffered with ADHD. I had a ton of fun with ADHD. I know a lot of other people who suffered because of my ADHD, but I never suffered because of it. But, like, one of the places that I found you could have an immense amount of fun is church. And Christians haven't got the memo on this, right? And so we tried a lot of different kinds of churches. And one of the churches that we went to in the 1980s, they had this thing called call to worship. And so the idea was you'd get there about 15 minutes before the church started, and they play this really soft melodic music, right? And then they would, and so then while you're sitting there, you were supposed to pray or contemplate or something. And then after that, they would have the worship team come out and lead the congregation in worship. Apparently, this didn't make it to Canada. It didn't last long. It was a horrible idea, especially if you're an ADHD kid. You know, sitting there quietly for 15 minutes, that's torture for an ADHD kid. So I told my mom, I said, excuse me, I need to go use the restroom. So I got up. Well, what I did is I went and explored the church a little bit. I found this little room off the sanctuary where all the musical instruments were kept. And I thought, oh, this is going to be awesome. Again, I'm like 6 or 7. So I just went and I quickly untuned every single music instrument. And then I ran back to my seat and I sit next to my mom and I'm just like, I can't wait for church to start. And she's like, she noticed. She's like, Israel, you're behaving so well today. This is so unusual for you. I'm like, I'm just excited about church, Mom. And so the worship team comes out, and the guy who's the lead singer, he's got this guitar, and You know, he comes out and I remember he held his guitar pick in his hand and he raises it up. You know, he's trying to be a little rock star ish, and so he's like, "Are you ready to worship?" And everybody's like, "Yeah." He's like, "No, I can't hear you. Are you ready to worship?" And they're like, "Yeah." And I remember they hit that first chord and it was awesome. I so wish YouTube was a thing. I would still be making money off of that video today. And so we ended up going to a different church. But this other church that we went to was really cool because they had a balcony. And I was sitting up there with some of these other boys and during the service, and we had lined up. There was a little space between the floor and the rail of the balcony. You know, it's about maybe 6 inches, but we lined up paper airplanes all the way along. And the idea was after the service, after the sanctuary had cleared out, we were just going to launch all the paper airplanes off into the seats, right? Well, that would have been probably a fine thing to do, except somehow one of those paper airplanes during the service got kicked. And it was amazing because it was like slow motion in a movie. As this thing starts careening out into the congregation, and it just hovered very slowly and very gently. But because we were in the back of the auditorium, the only person who saw it was the pastor. And so I see him kind of like moving his head in rhythm with the airplane. He's following it. And wouldn't you know, it had to have been providence. There's no other way that this airplane could have been guided as strategically as it was to this woman with a really big hairdo. And it landed right in the top of her hair. And because she had so much hair piled up, she didn't see it. And most of the people in the congregation didn't see it, but the pastor did. And pastors are godly men, but they're also human. And this guy, he was barely trying to hold it together. He's just like, so turning into Galatians. He's trying really hard not to lose it. And so, anyway, I had a lot of fun in church. Found out that other people didn't always feel that way. So, we found a different church. When I was in sixth grade, we got busted for homeschooling, and so we ended up, my mom put me and my sister in a private school. And this was a one-room schoolhouse that had probably 40 students from K to 8. My sister, did I mention I had a perfect older sister? Yeah, I did that. I did mention that. She was teacher's pet, and I was teacher's nightmare. We couldn't have been more opposite, and the teacher would send home notes with each of us periodically for my mother to read, which was terrible because the teacher hated me. Okay, let me just tell you what happened. The teacher built a cardboard cubicle that was 6 foot high and put it around my desk for the whole year. I was grounded from recess for the whole year. And basically, I sat inside of this cardboard cubicle for an entire school year, doodling in my textbooks. And if I had to, the only time that I was allowed to leave the cubicle during the school day was if I needed to use the restroom, I could take the Christian flag and wave it up over the cardboard cubicle. And he would come and look at me and he would say, "Yes." I would say, "I need to use the restroom." And he'd be like, "Okay, go and come right back. Don't touch anything. Don't destroy anything. Go. Anyway, so then I would come back and I would sit in the cardboard cubicle. And the cardboard cubicle was not to help me learn. The cardboard cubicle was to give him some semblance of order over the rest of his class so that hopefully he could teach some other students because he'd completely given up on teaching me. And so we'd get these notes and my mom always read my sister's note first. It was like, "Sony is the most wonderful student. She completes all of her tasks on time. She gets along well with others. She's one of the best students I've ever seen, blah, blah, blah." And then she'd read mine. Israel is a terrible student. He never applies himself. He never finishes any of his studies. It was just negative. The guy just, he was just a negative guy. That's my opinion anyway. But you know how you hear from kids who struggle, and then at some point you'll hear about that someone in their life like believed in them, right? Somebody took an interest. Maybe it was a coach, maybe it was a teacher, maybe it was a grandparent. Like somebody saw some potential in them, right? Well, I'll never forget the day that I finally got a positive note. And my mom read my sister's glowing note, and then she finally read my note. And for the first time ever, the teacher wrote something nice. He said, "Israel is trying." I almost cried. I was like, "Yes, finally." Then she read the rest of the note. "Very, very trying." Yeah, there was nothing redemptive in it at all. It's just, he still hated me. So anyway, I share all of that to say that I have some experience with this from a personal level. But as I became an adult, I actually wanted to kind of understand this from a more clinical viewpoint. Like, what is it that makes someone this way, right? What is it that causes someone to behave in this manner? And I believe that to some extent, the way that you treat a situation like this will vary rather radically based on what you think is causing it. And so there seem to be four primary cause theories about what causes someone to behave in these types of ways. The first one is what's called a mental dysfunction, and this is comes out of more of a psychological determinism. It often is believed that there's a genetic component to this, and that there's something that is wired wrong in the child's brain that causes them to act out in these ways. Now, if something is genetically inherited and it's a part of your DNA, you can't change your DNA. That you are just who you are. And so you're deterministically kind of hardwired to be the way and programmed to be the way that you are. So you can't ever fix the problem if it's indeed genetic. And the only way that you can really treat it, according to the medical professionals, is that you can take medications that will help to alleviate some of the external symptoms. So you're not curing it, you're just treating symptoms. With the medications, of course, there are some people who seem to respond well to it. It does seem to give them more clarity and focus. And there's others who really have a very difficult time with the medications. I've had a lot of friends who were medicated who really regret having been medicated, particularly as children. I was not medicated. I'm very thankful for that. My personal view, and again, this is just, so there's the word of God, which is true for all people in all places and all times. And then there's my opinion, which is not worth a whole lot, right? But every once in a while, I'll actually have an opinion on something. My personal opinion on this is that I would feel much more comfortable as a parent in allowing a child to make those decisions about medication when they're an adult and have agency. Because when they're a child, if they have adverse reactions to this, and I've seen so many even of my friends who actually said that they became so depressed because of the medications, they were suicidal, and that they said it was just very fortunate that they didn't kill themselves because of the impact that the medication itself was having on them. And I would hate to be responsible for something like that where, you know, they many of them, again, some didn't have negative reactions to it, but others said it just was so so devastating to them that I would feel more comfortable if they're an adult and they're making their own medical decisions regarding medication. That just makes more sense to me personally. That's my view, my opinion. The other view is that it's not so much physiological. It's not so much something in your genes or something that is inherited or even that your brain is necessarily wired incorrectly, so to speak. But that you are responding to something in your childhood, some sort of external stimuli, maybe a relational dynamic. You may be acting out in negative ways because of trauma, or maybe because of a stressful situation. You have anxiety in some way, and typically this falls under the psychological heading of behaviorism, which is usually treated through some kind of counseling or therapy or something like that. And then there's other views that that kind of fall under a physiological framework, but more environmental. So a physical dysfunction viewpoint would be that this is caused by, say, your diet. caffeine, sugars, food dyes, artificial colors, artificial flavors. You know, you have food allergies, or you're reacting to molds or pollens or whatever. Like, there can be a lot of different theories about something that's happening environmentally that is impacting behavior. And then some people look at it as that this is a spiritual issue, that this is bad parenting, it's bad child training, they're not getting enough discipline. Sadly, there was a pastor in the United States recently who said these children don't have ADHD, they're just demon possessed. That's not helpful. And so there are people who sometimes view it as a spiritual thing or a character thing. And again, I think it matters a little bit what you think the cause is. And what I found is that parents tend to dial down on one of these, and they're really not open to discussing the possibility of it being something other than their preconceived idea. So it's actually a little dangerous for me to be on a stage talking about it, because people usually have intensely personal reasons for believing what they do on these issues. And it's personal, right? Because it's their child and they care deeply about it. So it can be a little dicey to discuss these things. The one thing I will say is that even to this day, although the predominant view of the medical establishment is that this is a biological, genetically inherited disorder, they have found no ADD or ADHD gene. Okay, so there is no strand of DNA that is found in all people who have these kinds of behaviors that they've identified. And even so, most medical doctors believe that if you did have some sort of a genetic mutation or strand of DNA code that was similar, it wouldn't be sufficient enough to actually alter or change behavior. So in terms of this theory, it is a theory, but it is an unsubstantiated theory. And so, you know, if you've ever had a child that's been diagnosed with ADD or ADHD, you probably are aware that there's no blood test, right? They're not testing your blood to see if there is some kind of a genome issue. They're not. They don't, in most cases, do brain scans. They ask questions. And they ask questions like, does your child tend to, you know, chew on electric cords, and do they tend to traumatize the UPS man, and, you know, things like that. And so when you answer yes to a series of questions, they say, aha, your child has ADD or ADHD. And really, almost all disorders, this is kind of important to understand this, with most disorders, there are some that truly have been proven to be biological, but for the most part, they simply describe a behavior, okay? It's not a sickness. ADD is not a sickness. Like, I caught the virus. It's not a virus that you catch. You know, oppositional defiant disorder, that describes a behavior. I don't like being told what to do. Okay, so if they ask a series of questions and find out that your child does not like to be told what to do, they will label them with oppositional defiant disorder. There's no ODD gene and there's no ODD virus. You're not sick. They're just simply describing the behavior. So there are people who seem to have similar behaviors. And I'm not against the labels from the standpoint that sometimes a label can be a very helpful handle to pick up an idea and carry it around and move it around. Sometimes we just get to a matter much, much quicker if you use a label. Does that make sense? So, like, for example, if you and I are talking theology and I ask you, what are your theological views? You could tell me for 3 hours what you believe. And then at the end of that, I would be like, oh, so you're a Pentecostal. Oh, okay. Well, that you could have told me that up front. We could have saved a lot of time, right? So in a certain way, but like, there's not like a virus or a gene that makes you a Pentecostal or Reformed or Anabaptist, right? There's not. It describes a belief system, and these labels describe a behavior. And so they can be helpful because they help us to identify that there are people who believe a certain way and there are people who behave a certain way, but we still don't actually know what the root cause is. Does that make sense? So the idea that this is genetically inherited or that it is a rewiring of the brain, those things are medical theories, which may or may not be true, they're just not proven. And again, there's no physiological test for ADD or ADHD. there are other issues like autism, for example, which is very clearly biological, real autism. I'm going to throw this out there, and please don't get offended at me, but I don't know if it's happened here in Canada yet, but I think we're doing a real disservice to people who are genuinely autistic. By now in the United States, they've made this autism spectrum. Any person on the planet can get a diagnosis of being on the autism spectrum. I kid you not. And so that makes it really not helpful when now 100% of the population is on the autism spectrum. It hinders the ability to actually help people who are truly biologically autistic, if that makes sense. So I think that there is certainly a possibility of this having some kind of a biological component to it. But I also think we need to be careful that we don't simply buy into propaganda about it, that we're careful in the way that we look at it. Here's what I have kind of come to on this issue. Again, if you believe that your child is acting this way because they're genetically pre-programmed to do this, then they're not going to change that if you spank them more. They're not going to change that if you lecture them more. And they're not going to change that if you put a peppermint essential oil on them. Because you can't change your genes, right? But if you believe that this is caused by diet, for example, and that you need to give them an elimination diet and take them off of corn and dairy and wheat and all these things, well, then again, you're still not buying into the spiritual theory that this is a parenting problem, or you're not buying into the view that this is caused by some kind of emotional trauma that they're reacting against. You're going to be really dialed on that one thing. And most parents, as I said, I think they pick one issue and they really hone in on it. And I read this passage, which I've read a million times and you have as well, but one day it jumped out at me in a different way. In Luke 10:27, Jesus affirmed this statement, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all of your mind." And what I realized there is that in this verse, Jesus is describing a person as being comprised of these four attributes. And he says that they're supposed to love God with all of this. So the heart is obviously the seat of the emotions. The soul is the spiritual component of our life. Strength has to do with our physical body. And our mind is our mental aspect. And so all four of these cause theories, the mental, the emotional, physical, and spiritual, Jesus is saying we have all of these things as part of who we are in our humanity. And what I believe is, as I've thought about this and pondered this a little bit more, is that sometimes I think we do ourselves a disservice by trying to separate these things out and not recognize that we really are integrated in ways that we don't even understand. And that our physical and our emotional and our spiritual and mental aspects, they dovetail and they overlap and they intersect in ways that are really confusing and that are integral, but in ways we don't always understand. Like, for example, I am diagnosed I have a genetic predisposition to type 2 diabetes. And so I have blood sugar issues. And if I go too far between meals or I don't get enough protein or whatever, I'll have a blood sugar drop. And when that blood sugar drop happens, my world changes. And I can feel very panicked. And before I knew that I had this, I thought there was something wrong with me on like an emotional and spiritual level. Because I would be at an airport, for example, and all of a sudden I just felt really panicky. Sometimes my hands would start to shake. I didn't know why. It wasn't like I was intentionally afraid of a particular thing, but I just started to feel very panicky and not okay. Sometimes I just, this sense of panic would come over me, and I would just think, what is wrong with me? Why am I doing this? And I began to question my spiritual maturity. And just like, is this some kind of spiritual attack, or am I having a mental breakdown? Is it a panic attack? What is it? Well, I found out it was a physiological cause. It was a blood sugar drop, but it affected my emotions. And then because it affected my emotions, it affected my mind. Then my mind started to ask questions about my spirituality. And these things are just interlaced. I mean, to some extent, you know, you just get a bad flu and it affects your mood, right? And you just have a different perspective. And so all of these things, you know, there are people who, I just talked with a friend of mine recently who had some severe trauma in his life. And because of the severe trauma, he had pent-up anxiety that he was not dealing with, and it created physical problems. He actually killed his adrenal system because of the stress load that he was carrying related to not having healthy ways to be able to deal with his trauma that he experienced. So it started as an emotional trauma that led to a kind of mental distress, which caused a physical breakdown in his body. So, do you see where I'm going with this? These things are very interlaced, and I just feel like one of the things that would be very helpful for us as parents is to realize that all of these things may have some component with this, that there could be physical aspects, there could be mental aspects, there could be emotional aspects, and maybe we need to take a more entire person, I don't like to use the word holistic because I know that has baggage, but a more integrated kind of view of the person and how we deal with this. So let's look at the emotions. You know, one of the things that I think helps the child to feel the most secure in their childhood is knowing that their mom and dad have a good relationship with each other. Sometimes people say, what's the best thing that I could do for my ADD or ADHD child? And I say, well, it's the same thing you can do for all of your children, have a good marriage. And I know that doesn't sound like the kind of advice you're probably going to get from a professional. As I told you earlier, I'm not a professional. But I think that when children know that things are not okay with their parents, they feel an enormous amount of stress and they can begin to act out. In fact, I saw a survey in a secular magazine that asked the question of children, and it asked them, if you had to choose between your parents being okay with each other or your parents being okay with you relationally, which one would you choose? And universally, children said, I would rather my parents be okay with each other than be okay with me. Because they know that if mom and dad are okay with each other, that they still have a safe environment. But all of us grew up in a divorce culture. My parents divorced when I was 6. And so I understand the kind of trauma that can result from that. And I think that some of my behavior was rooted in insecurity and in stress that was related to to their relationship and the fallout, you know, that happened after that. Another thing is, like, when a child is raised with anger, that really can become destructive in terms of the way that they express themselves and the way that they behave. And it's so common for us with children who are really high strung and who are really high, have really high emotions and energy and all that, to have more anger or frustration toward them. And so sometimes we do parent them differently than we parent our other children, which isn't good, but that can also exacerbate the problem. And then the kind of entertainment that they're exposed to, aggressive music or violent entertainment. I read a book by a medical doctor who dealt with stress-related or physical-related issues caused by technology. And one of the things that he talked about was violent movies or even aggressive music, but particularly he talked about video games. And he said that when you watch a movie, you psychologically, hope I don't scare you here, but this is his explanation of it. Psychologically, subconsciously, you put yourself into the movie as the main character. So in your mind, you become that character. You're the hero. You're always the hero in the movie. And so when the hero is walking down a dark alley and then someone jumps out and goes, ah, and like scares or threatens the hero, you're sitting in the safety of your living room on a couch. No one is threatening you. There's no risk to your life. And what do? You jump and you gasp, right? Because they just threatened you in your imaginary world. You had an adrenaline rush that went through your system that is God-given, because God created our adrenal system, and it creates what's called a fight-or-flight mechanism. You don't control it. You don't ask for it. It just happens automatically. But he said that when this adrenaline rush happens, it's because you're supposed to protect yourself. If you're walking down the street and a dog jumps out at you and attacks you, you either fight the dog or you turn around and run as fast as you know how in the opposite direction from the dog to save your life. So this adrenal system is great. God gave it to us. It's a wonderful thing. But in the movie, you're not getting any physical exertion. You're just sitting there. So action movies, your life got threatened. 3 seconds later, it gets threatened again. And video games, it's constant. You are the avatar in the video game, and your virtual life is being threatened over and over and over again. So what happens is you get adrenaline rush, adrenaline rush, adrenaline rush, adrenaline rush, and you have nowhere to go with that. And he said the only way that you can possibly reset 30 minutes of aggressive video game playing is you need to sleep for 7 hours to give your body a chance to reset, or you have to have sustained physical exercise for 30 minutes to offset that 30 minutes of a video game. And most people who are gamers don't get that. He said, in fact, those are the two things most gamers don't have, is enough physical exercise and sleep. And so, again, you can create all kinds of health problems in your body when you are not having a release for those pent-up emotions. So there's a lot, I think, on the emotional side to be considered. And really, what is the go-to babysitter that parents utilize for the ADHD child? It's movies, it's television, and it's video games. Why? Because then they can sit there and watch that, and I can get something done. So again, the mind, I think these same things, they affect our thinking, they affect our emotions, and also our mental processes. The body, I think it is important to think about diet. And even if these things don't cause ADHD, they certainly can contribute to the behavior. I remember as a child that when we would go to some of these churches that we visited, because we moved to a lot of different kinds of churches, it wasn't my fault. It's just my parents got embarrassed and they didn't want to go back. But when we go to some of these churches, there were these elderly women in the church who believed it was their ministry from God to slip candy to children. My mother, I'll be honest, didn't like these elderly women. I loved them. I just want to tell you, ladies, if that's your ministry, God bless you. But my mom always knew when this had happened, because she would find me somewhere standing in place, just jumping up and down. And she would be like, "Did you have candy?" And I'd be like, "Yep." And so I was not allowed to have sugar or caffeine, if she could prohibit it, growing up, because it just ramped it up to a whole nother level. And she just saw that that wasn't helpful for me. So obviously thinking about all of those kinds of things that we're putting into our body, and much of our diets today are simply not healthy. Certainly whole foods, and as close as possible to being homegrown vegetables and meats and so forth are just so much more beneficial than the processed foods that we eat. Also, I would encourage every parent, make sure that your child has vision and hearing testing. Because if your child can't see well or they can't hear well, they're going to have academic problems, and they're also sometimes going to have what you perceive to be behavioral problems. I have two sons who were diagnosed with auditory processing disorder. Now, that's a tricky one, because when we had them taken to the hearing doctor, because I'm like, these boys don't hear. So we took them to the doctor, and they're like, they hear fine. And I'm like, all right, game over. But I told my wife, like, now I still think there's something, like, I think there's something wrong here. And so we took them to lots of doctors who just tested their hearing, but then we took them for auditory processing. And what the doctors told us is that they hear fine, but when it gets in their brain, it gets all scrambled. And so we learned a very simple technique from the doctors about how to help our boys with auditory processing. They said what it is like background noise cancels out what you said. And so they physically did hear it, but it didn't process. So they said, take them in another room where there's not the background noise, give them an instruction, have them repeat it back to you, and then by that, then since they repeat it back that they've heard it, and then hold them accountable if they're not doing what they're told. Game changer. And like, we just didn't have the same problems anymore. They would do what they were asked. And so it's because we made sure that they actually had processed what we said and not just said it to them across the room and then assumed that it took. So those are two things on the physical aspect. The spiritual aspect, of course, with every child, you're going to want to teach them the Word of God. You're going to want to pray with them. And people ask me all the time, well, how do we discipline a child who is attention deficit or hyperactive? And I always tell them, the same way that you do your other children. There's not like some different way that you discipline this child. I think you'll have more opportunities to discipline, But you should never discipline with more severity. I think that you should be loving. You should be, not in anger. But you do need to discipline the child. And my mother was really wise because she never disciplined me for being hyper. She disciplined me for sinning. So, like, if I was destroying someone's property, or I was harming someone, or I was doing something that was harming myself, I would get disciplined. But if I was just being hyper, I never got disciplined for that, because there's nothing wrong with that. Well, you don't want to destroy that activity in a child, because God put it there. God put it in them on purpose because he wanted them to have it, because it's going to help them be successful later in life. As odd as it seems, it really helps me with what I do as a public speaker. Because people who speak who don't have ADHD are boring. And you don't, when you come to my sessions, because you don't know what I'm going to do. And the reason you don't know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know what I'm going to say. I don't know how this, I don't know where this is going. So you don't want to destroy that energy, but it does need to be channeled. Learning how to channel that is important. Practical tip. Let me just say this while it's on my mind. One way to help these easily distractible children is to give them like 15 minutes on, 10 minutes off. I'm not saying this will work for you, but you could try it. Because I did better with short doses. 15 minutes of focus, 10 minutes, go run around the yard, get some energy out, come back in, jump back into it, another 15 minutes. This whole sit there for an hour thing, my brain had fizzled out at 15 minutes and there was no productivity was going to happen in the last 45 minutes. So I think you'll find more success if you do shorter spurts of academics with breaks in between. And then as I kind of try to wrap this up, I actually have a theory that the ADD issue is 180 degrees in the opposite direction of what the experts tell us. Now, it's daunting to make a statement like that because there are thousands of PhD researchers that have told us that the problem is that children have an inattentiveness problem and that they can't focus and they can't pay attention. And I think they're all wrong. That's a little presumptive, right? You got to have a little chutzpah to be like, 1,000 PhD researchers are all wrong and I'm right. But I'm just wired that way. So here's what really tipped it off to me. I was at a hotel room one time and I was watching a documentary on ADD. And they had a 12-year-old boy that they were interviewing and they asked him, what does it mean when they say that you have ADD? And it was the oddest thing, and it just burned into my brain because this 12-year-old boy, he was, he seemed like a fairly normal child, but then when he answered the question, he became like a robot. He looked into the camera and he gave this like almost automated kind of robotic response that I found creepy. And so he just said, ADD means that I cannot focus and I cannot pay attention. I cannot focus on anything at all except that which I am very interested in. And the only thing that I am interested in is video games. And then he grinned this like weird cheesy grin. And I remember I jumped up off of my hotel bed and I pointed at the TV and I said, dude, you gave away the whole farm. You gave away the whole thing. The problem is not that they can't focus. It's not that they can't pay attention. It's 180 degrees in the opposite direction. The problem is actually hyper-focus. It's not that they can't focus. They hyper-focus. And I'll prove this to you. The next time your child, your ADD, ADHD child is playing a video game, I double dog dare you to go call that child to lunch and see what happens. You will have to go physically stand between the child and the screen and wave your arms like a maniac and be like, Johnny, Earth to Johnny, I am your mother. I gave you birth. Please come back to us. We have missed you. people on our planet would like to see you again. Please join us for lunch. And he'll be trying to look around you. What did you move? You know, I mean, and then if you go and actually physically switch the TV off, he'll probably be playing it for 30 seconds after it's switched off. Like, and then it's going to be 3 or 4 minutes before he even knows what universe he's in. He'll be walking around and say, huh, what do we do with lunch? What food? What? And, I mean, can he not focus? Yeah, he's hyper-focused, right? I was actually, as an adult, I was writing an article. This is the irony of it. Writing an article on the topic of ADD. And at a certain point, it dawned on me, a few minutes ago, my wife walked into my office and she asked me something. And then she left. And I think I answered her, but I have no idea what she asked and I have no idea what I said. And so I got up and I walked into the kitchen where she was working and I said, honey, a few minutes ago you came in the office and you know you said something to me and I think I answered you. And what did I say? And she grinned. She said, you said yes. I said, how much is this going to cost me? And the problem was I was hyper-focused on what? On what I was very interested in. Just like this 12-year-old boy. He was hyper-focused on the thing he was, and what was the only thing he was interested in? Video games. Your child can focus. Your ADD, ADHD child can focus, but here's what they choose to do. They choose to focus on the thing they are very interested in. The problem is that's usually very narrow, and it does not include you. The one thing they, I promise you this, the one thing they are not interested in at all is you. You are a complete distraction from the thing that they want to do. And then this is true for most children, but most children modulate. These ADHD, ADD children don't. Most children from 3 years old and up, they wake up and this is their mindset. Today, I want to do everything that I want to do, and I do not want anyone to get in my way. And that's how almost every child starts their day. The problem is the ADD, ADHD child, they're still doing it at 12. Okay, so where do we go with that? Well, what you want to do is you want to try to channel this energy and this focus into two things, worship of God and love and service of other people. Because we're all born selfish. But that hyper-focus accompanied with selfishness usually creates some really dysfunctional relationships. So you want to teach this person how to come out of themselves, how to stop being so interned, how to stop being so self-focused, and learn how to love and serve other people rather than thinking about themselves all the time. And that can be a challenge. I saw a copy of Worship Leader magazine, and they said almost every worship leader in a church has been diagnosed with ADHD. Seriously, like they did a study on it. Well, you know, I think David had ADHD. I know Peter had ADHD. I promise you that guy did, right? I mean, you know, he's in the boat. He sees Jesus. He's like, wah! He's like, you know, nobody else did that. They're like, oh, it was Peter. He forgot to take his meds today. So God wires people that way, and then they're awesome, right? Peter's preaching at Pentecost, and David's writing the Psalms, and I'm up here on a stage teaching, right? I remember my mom used to tell me, she said, you know, Israel, she told me this when I was a little kid. She said, I believe someday God is going to use you and you are going to speak to people all around the world, which I've done. She said, you're going to speak to people all around the world. God's going to use that gift that he gave you of talking. But until that day, would you shut it? Because you are driving me nuts. Anyway, this book, I think, is especially helpful for all parents because, you know, getting angry and stressed out with our children is a universal problem. My wife and I have found in the years that we've been doing parenting seminars that there's two kinds of parents. There are parents who struggle with anger and stress, and there are parents who lie. Some of you will get that on Monday. But especially if you have this high-strung type of child, you probably have more reasons to get frustrated with them. This book, I think, will be exceptionally helpful. And then again, this book, Raising Them Up, Parenting for Christians, those books are going to be helpful. So again, I encourage you to check out all my books. They're at the Learning House. I think I said that wrong, didn't I? The Learning House? Yes, the Learning House. And I also encourage you to visit our website, sign up on our email. I haven't mentioned this, I don't think, but we have a podcast. Right now, it's on all the audio streaming things. It's called Family Renewal. But the YouTube channel is the video version of it. So if you go to YouTube and you look up Family Renewal Podcast, you can subscribe to our YouTube podcast, and we would love to have you there. We also, my wife and I run a Facebook group that's a parent discussion group that's called Raising Them Up, Parenting for Christians. And it is the same name as the title of this book. So Raising Them Up, Parenting for Christians, a Facebook discussion. We have about 8,000 parents in the group. I am totally against the idea of going on Facebook and asking for parenting advice. I have a hierarchy of where I think you should go for parenting advice. And I have on my list, towards the bottom of the list, like strangers you meet in dark alleys. And then right below that, Facebook groups. So I'm not a fan of them, but they're out there, and it's where millennials are going to get their answers about how to parent their children. They get 200 pieces of 200 answers from people they don't know who are less qualified than they are to talk about parenting, and somehow that's supposed to be helpful. So I'm really not selling my group very well here. But I'm just saying, like, if you're going to go do something stupid like join a Facebook group to get random strangers advice on parenting, please don't do that. But if you do that, ours might be one of the better places to go. I have one more session on education versus schooling yet this afternoon. Let me just say this too. I just thank you guys for being so warm and welcoming to me. I've had conversations with many of you, and this has been a delightful conference. You know, sometimes as a speaker, it feels like it's all outgo. And this conference has been a little different. You know, I feel like you guys have just shown me a lot of love, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Once again, the Manitoba Association of Christian Homeschools would like to thank the Learning House for sponsoring this recording. Please visit them at learninghouse.ca.